The World is supported in part by listeners like you, and for a limited time, if you join them and make a gift to The World, your donation will be matched. That means double the support for our in-depth coverage of the day's top stories, brought to you with context, perspective, and heart. Donate today at theworld.org/match, and thanks. On this day of thanks, Hong Kong demonstrators are grateful for American support.
People feel like they need to thank the countries that have been helping Hong Kong and urge them to help more.
Also today, we're taking a trip down the Mississippi River on boats, planes, and canoes paddling through muddy backwaters.
Did anybody get torn up by the thorns?
An 1,100-mile journey to find out how this iconic waterway connects America to the rest of the world.
1 in 12 people on Earth ingest food made from Mississippi River Basin produced products. And that is dependent on a working, ecologically healthy Mississippi River Basin.
But the river's ecological health is a big question mark. I'm Marco Werman. Today's top stories and the global stakes along the Mississippi on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. This Thanksgiving, the holiday spirit moved President Trump to pay a surprise visit to U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
There's nowhere I'd rather celebrate this Thanksgiving than right here with the toughest, strongest, best and bravest warriors on the face of the earth. You are indeed that.
The president arrived in a darkened airplane and carried out a presidential tradition, feeding turkey and mashed potatoes to American troops. It was Trump's first visit to Afghanistan as president. He said he'd restart peace negotiations with the Taliban. This comes 3 months after he canceled talks with them.
The Taliban wants to make a deal. We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see. But they want to make a deal. And they only want to make a deal because you're doing a great job. That's the only reason they want to make a deal. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Afghan soldiers for really, I've spoken to a lot of you today, and you say they're really fighting hard. I was very impressed with that, actually, so I want to thank you.
Trump said the U.S. would stay until there is a deal or total victory. He also said he'd like to reduce the number of American troops. Trump also met with Afghanistan's president, Ashraf Ghani, today. In an unusual move, Ghani joined Trump on stage with U.S. troops at Bagram Air Base. Ghani praised Trump as the architect of a strategy for wiping out al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There are people also full of thanks in Hong Kong today, although it looks more like the 4th of July. Throngs of protesters waving American flags, others singing the Star-Spangled Banner. The demonstrators are offering thanks to President Trump for signing a bill that backs Hong Kong's pro-democracy protesters. Nathan Law is a key figure in that democracy movement. In 2016, he was elected to Hong Kong's legislature, but was later expelled from the parliament under pressure from Beijing. He's now studying at Yale University. We talked about the videos posted online of the celebrations in the streets of Hong Kong last night.
People were gathering in the heart of Hong Kong, hundreds and thousands of people holding up cell phone lights and cheering for victory.
I'm also seeing a lot of flags. There are British flags, of course, a lot of American flags. And there's somebody with a Statue of Liberty hat with like little LED lights. It's pretty amazing. What does that tell us about the connections between Hong Kong and the United States, do you think?
This is a leaderless movement, so people express their opinion freely inside the assembly. Some may hold like American flags, some may hold UK flags. People feel like they need to thank the countries that have been helping and urge them to help more.
I'm looking at one flag that has a picture of a tank that says Trump on it, and Trump is standing with an assault rifle on top of the tank very proudly.
The whole assembly is not meant to like make Trump into the hero of Hong Kong, but a way that people express their gratitude.
President Trump also signed a bill banning the export of tear gas, rubber bullets, and stun guns to the police in Hong Kong. Do you think that's significant or mostly symbolic?
The police now, they have been firing the tear gas made in China, which is more dangerous to themselves and more uncertain about what it contains. So I think the ban actually released a message that, according to like international standards, does not agree on how the government or the police have been using these crowd control weapons. And I hope that even like in Europe, the other countries who have been selling weapons to the police force could follow that path.
At the same time, Washington is trying to negotiate this trade deal with China, and I'm wondering if you're concerned that a successful trade deal could reframe Hong Kong for Washington as a secondary concern to good economic ties with the Chinese mainland.
The trade deal is just part of the picture. The most important thing is how we could restrain the expansion of the authoritarianism and how we could stop China abusing the power they have in order to suppress people. So I think regardless of how the trade deal has been doing, I think we need to uphold these principles.
Does the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong think it can trust Washington? Because President Trump has been pretty non-committal to your movement in the past. He's also called China's leader, Xi Jinping, an incredible guy. So is Trump a reliable ally?
Well, I think the Hong Kong issue in the U.S. is having strong bipartisan support. Regardless of the personal character of President Trump, we're not lying our trust or our faith on one single person. But we are relying on a shared community that with the same values and with the same pursuit of democracy to hold hands together. And we are like in trust of the bipartisan support in the U.S. Of course, the fight in Hong Kong is also a global fight. We're in the forefront of the clashes of values. We are at the forefront of stopping the expansion of authoritarianism. And we got mutual benefits.
Nathan Law is a key figure in Hong Kong's democracy movement. He's now studying at Yale. Thanks for being with us. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much.
There's another growing source of tension between the U.S. and China, TikTok. In case you don't know, TikTok is a wildly popular app to post short videos. It's owned by a Chinese company, and critics say it's being censored. Not just things posted in China, content posted anywhere. Critics point to one recent post here in the U.S. that got taken down. It's a video that begins with some beauty tips, but you also get something extra. Here's The World's Lydia Emanalidou.
This video starts out like any other beauty tutorial you'd find online.
Hi, guys. I'm going to teach you guys how to get long lashes.
The 17-year-old who made this TikTok, her name is Feroza Aziz, and she recorded it where she lives in New Jersey. She sits close to the camera, facing it. She has long, dark hair draped over one of her shoulders. She's wearing a black shirt, sporting a baby blue scrunchie around her right wrist, and she's holding a pink eyelash curler up to her face.
So the first thing you need to do is grab your lash curler, curl your lashes, obviously.
And then Feroza's tone changes, and the video takes a turn. She tells people watching to put down their eyelash curlers.
And use your phone that you're using right now to search up what's happening in China.
What's happening in China is a brutal government crackdown on Muslims in the country, mainly ethnic Uyghurs. The Chinese government is accused of rounding up as many as 1 million people over the past 3 years, locking them up in internment camps and prisons across the remote province of Xinjiang in northwest China.
Separating their families from each other, kidnapping them, murdering them, raping them, forcing them to eat pork, forcing them to drink.
The Chinese government denies all of this. Feroza, who's a high school junior, told me over the phone that she found out about what's going on in Xinjiang through social media.
And I thought, this cannot be true. This China can't be doing this to their own people. And I searched up, and sure enough, they are. It's been confirmed by the UN. It broke my heart. And as a Muslim growing up in America, as an Afghan, I thought, it's my duty, it's my job to speak about this and to spread awareness.
So last weekend, she took to TikTok. Now, she didn't have a huge following. She wasn't well known. But she thought maybe if she made the video look like a beauty tutorial, it'd get more views. It was bait and switch, basically. And it worked.
On Sunday, I woke up to a million views on there. And I was like, wow, I need to create two more videos on this issue because there's a lot of questions regarding what's happening. So I created that. And then on Monday, I woke up to see the message that my account was suspended.
So here's what happened. TikTok made it so that Feroza couldn't access the app from her phone and took down the video. Many are saying this is because of TikTok's connections to China. Remember, it's owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. Feroza knew about those connections when she got on TikTok. She also knew that the Chinese government has a tight grip on what people there can say online. But she never expected that those rules would impact her, a teen thousands of miles away in New Jersey. There have been other accusations in the past that TikTok censors videos that criticize the Chinese government, accusations the company strongly denies. They say that the way they moderate content here in the U.S. is not at all influenced by Beijing.
But that's not what former employees of TikTok say.
This is Senator Joshua Hawley, a Republican from Missouri, at a congressional hearing earlier this month. TikTok was invited to the hearing but didn't show up. And so Senator Hawley, facing the empty chair that had been set up for TikTok, brought up news reports that said that executives based in Beijing have the final say on what gets to go on TikTok, even if it's for users here in the U.S.
That's sure a different story than the one TikTok has told this committee. And that's a problem.
A problem because TikTok is super popular here in the U.S., especially among teens and young adults, and it's becoming a place where they learn about current events. So, for example, Feroza told me that when she posted that now viral video, that many teens replied saying it was the first time they'd ever heard about Xinjiang. As for that video, it is now back up. A TikTok spokesperson who didn't want to be recorded told me that the takedown was basically an accident. They've since apologized and given Feroza access to her account.
I don't think I really want to post on TikTok anymore, but at the same time, I don't want this to silence me. I will still spread awareness about these issues.
And she says there are plenty of other social media apps she could do that on. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
On yesterday's show, we heard from members of the U.S. military sharing stories about Thanksgiving spent overseas. Today, it's the turn of a career foreign service officer. They're the public servants who spend much of their working lives away from the U.S., often separated from family, and who, up until the impeachment hearings this month, were not really on the minds of the public.
Happy Thanksgiving. This is Laura Kennedy. I was a career foreign service officer, spent almost 40 years with the Department of State.
Kennedy served as ambassador to Turkmenistan, along with other posts in the Foreign Service. But when it comes to Thanksgiving memories, she goes straight back to her first posting overseas.
I'll never forget that first assignment in Moscow, 1977. It was my first overseas assignment. 3 weeks after I got there, brand new Foreign Service, I was still trying to sort of find my way. The embassy burned. It was a devastating fire. Knocked out our communications, all of our classified working area. Now, after this terrible fire, we were just engulfed with the effort to try and to repair the damages. So the whole priority went to getting back on our feet after the fire. And I hadn't received my what we call household effects. All shipments that were not essential, that were not geared to repairing the fire, had been held at our staging point up in Helsinki. So here was the winter coming on. There was a period that winter where the temperature stayed in the minus 30s for 3 weeks. It was a really brutal winter, and we were already getting snow at the beginning of September, and this was with a burned roof of the embassy itself. I had no winter clothes, so not a fun time. So the embassy very kindly gave me a break over Thanksgiving to go up, retrieve some of my goods, including winter coats and boots and things. So it was a treat, actually, to be up in Finland. On the other hand, on your own, first Thanksgiving away from family and so on. And the American ambassador there, who was the quite legendary Roz Ridgway, heard that I was in town, invited me, sight unseen, to her Thanksgiving dinner. So I sat down at her residence with her other guests, which included the embassy Marines, other folks like me who might not have family at post. And one, it was a lovely dinner, but the real value of it was that the ambassador reaches out to people who don't have their own Thanksgiving. But people just make do all over the world. There are increasingly around the world many people who are at unaccompanied posts. So they don't have the family to help them peel the potatoes and stuff the turkeys. They're really on their own. Then I'm talking about the fact that we've had huge numbers of Foreign Service people assigned in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in war zones, places where we have civil unrest. All over the world, Foreign Service people face all sorts of different situations. The main thing is that whether they have a full-scale turkey or just a frozen turkey burger, is the fact that they are overseas. They're delighted to be serving their country, but it reminds them of what you give up, and that is being away from your own friends and family and your country. And that's why Foreign Service folks support each other. You look after your colleagues, whether they're kith or kin, they are family.
Former Ambassador Laura Kennedy remembering her first Thanksgiving abroad as a Foreign Service officer in the Soviet Union. You're listening to The World. A quick note before we get back to the show. We're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we have the opportunity to receive $20,000 in matching funds to support our reporting. But we need you to join us and support The World to get those matching dollars. Your gift today will go so much further. It means double the support for our unparalleled coverage of issues like immigration, the environment, global security, and human rights. Reporting that you can't find pulled together in a single place anywhere else. Make a contribution today to support the global journalism you rely on. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. For the rest of this Thanksgiving Day, we're going to rebroadcast one of our favorite stories from earlier this year and take you on a journey down the Mississippi River.
All right, right side forward, left side still backwards.
If you want to take a canoe trip from Helena, Arkansas, down the Mississippi, in normal times, you just put your boat in the river and go.
All forwards.
But these are not normal times.
There's normally not any water back here. It's a bunch of willow trees, but right now it's all water. Water's all you can see.
That's canoe guide Tanner Algitz with the Quapaw River Company. And I'm Jason Margolis, a reporter with The World. This spring and summer, cities, farms, homes, and businesses near the river have been besieged by flooding. It was the wettest 12-month period ever recorded in the continental United States, driven by record precipitation throughout parts of the Midwest. Much of that rainwater and snowmelt made its way into the Mississippi drainage system and headed south. So finding a canoe path to the Mississippi River in Arkansas, paddling through thickets of trees that would normally be on dry land, well, it's a mess.
Did anybody get torn up by the thorns?
The challenge of our canoe ride will be the 21st century challenge confronting the river. Too much water. Eventually, after an hour of struggle covering a mile and a half as the crow flies, we punch through to the main channel of the Mississippi.
Looking good, y'all. Keep it going. Welcome to the Mississippi River.
Marco Werman back with you again. Today we're taking a trip down the Mississippi. The Mississippi of today barely resembles the water system Mark Twain described in the 1880s in his book Life on the Mississippi.
Considering the Missouri, its main branch, it is the longest river in the world, 4,300 miles. It seems safe to say that it is also the crookedest river in the world.
But since that time, engineers have shaped, contained, and dredged the river, transforming it into an efficient hydro superhighway to ship American products across the globe.
My customers for my corn are all overseas. They're all overseas, every one of them. And if our transportation efficiency falls...
Shackling the river has also brought some steep costs to the environment, wildlife, and cities and towns along the Mississippi. And the challenges are only growing as climate change is added to the mix. Wetter weather in the Midwest, more intense hurricanes, and sea level rise.
The flooding on the Mississippi is sure to cost billions of dollars in damage and also lost business there.
Massive flooding, homes underwater,
The Mississippi is buckling under the strain. The World's Jason Margolis brings us this story of a river system caught between competing interests.
The water that drains into the Mississippi comes from 32 states and two Canadian provinces. It all eventually pours out into the Gulf of Mexico.
It's called gravity. It's all got to pass here.
Here is Buras, Louisiana, about 60 miles southeast of New Orleans. Ryan Lambert runs duck hunting and fishing tours. His black lab Logan sits by his side in a flat-bottom boat. A century ago, the Mississippi River Delta was an area of vast coastal marshes. But in the battle between land and water, water is killing it.
Yeah, we've lost 2,000 square miles in the last 70 years, which is, you know, the Grand Canyon is 1,996 square miles. We've lost 2,000.
Put another way, it'd be like wiping an area the size of Delaware off the map. Then there's the football field stat. Everybody down here talks about the football field stat. Every 100 minutes, a football field's worth of land is swallowed by the sea.
While we're out here, we'll lose 3 footballs of land while we're out here. And it goes on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single day we're losing that land.
These wetlands aren't just critical to people who live, work, and play here. When hurricanes reach land, they lose strength and peter out. The coastal marshes serve as a crucial buffer, a shock absorber as storms barrel their way to the urban areas up north. Duck hunter Albertine Kimball has a message for the folks 60 miles away in New Orleans.
No wetlands equals no people. Just remember that. And we protect New Orleans. So if you don't save us, you next.
With climate change, scientists are predicting stronger and wetter hurricanes as ocean temperatures rise. Kimball says the impacts are already here.
If you're seeing a Mexican black-bellied tree duck here, I think things are changing. Absolutely, and the storms are getting more wicked too, you know. They're kicking us. I'm not a scientist still, let me state that fact.
But she says she knows the solution. The land here needs to be replenished.
But we want to live here, so how we do that, we got to compromise. That's it. If we don't compromise, none of us will be here.
So what exactly happened to Louisiana's coastal wetlands? Where did they go? The sand and dirt that replenishes Louisiana is still hundreds of miles up north. We'll dive further into that a bit later. The transformation of the Mississippi truly begins in the mid-19th century, explains Bob Criss, a professor emeritus of hydrogeology at Washington University in St. Louis.
If we look at an old lithograph from 1859, here's the fledgling city of St. Louis, and look at the steamboats. Look at this thing. Wow, wouldn't it have been great to
travel in luxury, unless you crashed, which happened frequently back then. Criss shows a map from the mid-19th century.
There are steamboat wrecks every mile for probably 1,000 miles, I don't know. Think of the commercial losses.
The untamed river also put military vessels at risk, and so the Army Corps of Engineers was brought in to shackle the Mississippi. They did their job, but not quite well enough. Cliff Dean runs the Delta Cultural Center Museum in Helena, Arkansas.
My first name is actually James. I switched over to my middle name because when I started teaching, James Dean was pretty famous. Or the Jimmy Dean smoked sausage and so
Cliff
forth.
Dean grew up in the Mississippi Delta, hearing about the Great Flood of 1927. An area roughly the size of Ireland was underwater. Some 500 people died and more than 600,000 were displaced. The Red Cross called it one of America's greatest peacetime disasters. Dean's grandparents lived through it. He says one morning they woke up surrounded by water.
And the sheriff came by, deputies, made everybody get in boats. You had to leave. And the men all had to go to try to shore up the levees or to build new ditches or something to try to stop the water. And if you didn't go, I mean, you had people actually shot that didn't go to the levee.
Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come.
When the Levee Breaks by Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie from 1929, the Mississippi River connects the American heartland to the rest of the globe. It also shares a lot of the world's environmental problems, and people on the bayou want them fixed.
They say, oh, we should have done it 50 years ago. Well, today's the first day of my grandchildren's 50 years. Let's start it off. Let's get going.
All crying will help you. Praying won't do no good. All crying will help you. Praying won't do no good. When the levee breaks.
Our 1,100-mile journey down the Mississippi continues just ahead.
I work on the levee, mama, both night and day. I work on the levee, mama, both night and day. The work's so hard, keep the water away.
You're with the world.
What do Goldman Sachs experts and leading thinkers have to say about trending shaping markets, industries, and the global economy? And what macroeconomic issues are on the minds of our clients? Listen to Goldman Sachs podcasts to find out. Available at www.gs.com/podcasts. or any of your favorite podcast platforms.
The Mississippi River broke all sorts of flood records this year.
People think we're nuts for living down here. I mean, how many people spend that much money to build that beautiful home knowing that the bottom's going to fill up with water? Us.
Learning to live with more water. We continue our journey down the Mississippi, ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. When the levee breaks, Led Zeppelin from the 1970s. Earlier, we were talking about the Great Flood of 1927, which inspired the song. We're devoting much of the show today to the Mississippi River, an iconic waterway that connects U.S. trade to the rest of the globe. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
After 1927, the U.S. Army Corps ramped up its efforts to contain the lower Mississippi. They built higher and deeper levees, along with flood control structures and spillways, to relieve stress during high water events. It was one of the most ambitious engineering projects on Earth, and it's largely worked to protect river cities and keep trade flowing. But with climate change, many people along the river, like Cliff Dean, worry about how much longer the intricate system can hold.
It used to be like the 27 flood. You might have 100 years before you have the next flood. Well, now we're beginning to get them every few years.
It's been a rough stretch along the Mississippi since Hurricane Katrina struck 14 years ago. Hydrogeologist Bob Criss isn't surprised by all the flooding.
The modern river is as featureless as a strand of spaghetti, and this has been done for navigation. Think of your blood pressure. If this is your blood system going through your body, you eat a bunch of gunk and clog up all your arteries. You're on life support. This river's on life support.
For many policymakers, the solution is expensive pumps and more levees or higher ones. They make good photo ops. But increasingly, many people now think more levees and walls aren't the solution. The city of Davenport, Iowa, is 950 miles north of New Orleans. Davenport decided that it isn't going to fight the river. That can come with a steep cost, though. This spring, several blocks of downtown were consumed by 4 to 6 feet of floodwater.
We would have been in water if we were driving where we are right now. In other words, we couldn't have driven here.
I drove around downtown Davenport with City Council member Marion McGinnis. The city did put up temporary flood walls, but they breached. Water gushed in, inundating buildings and cars within minutes. When the Mississippi's waters eventually retreated, they left behind caked mud and dead fish in the streets.
I mean, this is water filled with all kinds of unspeakable things because it's coming out of sewers, it's coming out of everywhere. So it's not something you want to go frolicking through at all.
Davenport has no permanent levee system to protect its waterfront. And that's by choice.
We like our river view. We want our river view. We love our river view. We can handle this.
Now, Davenport isn't ignoring the risks. Again, it did erect temporary flood walls this spring. But it also developed some natural solutions to deal with flooding. We drive along Davenport's 9-mile riverfront past several long, stretching waterfront parks.
The city had made decisions in the 80s and 90s to sort of clear property along the riverfront and let the river come in to a park. The idea is let the water come in and let it go back out.
The city has also restored some marshes to take in flood waters. It mimics a widely admired flood control system in the Netherlands called Room for the River. Davenport city leaders and even flooded out business owners say this helped minimize the damage this spring, and that flooding wasn't actually that bad. It was contained to just a few blocks. Davenport's mayor, Frank Klipsch, takes a holistic view of the river. Excess water has to go somewhere, and it will find the next vulnerable spot downstream.
We don't build walls and push our problems down to Arkansas, Louisiana, and Missouri. And yesterday I was on a national conference call, and the mayor of Grafton, Illinois, said, thanked us for doing that because their city might have been totally inundated and destroyed.
Natural solutions like wetlands restoration are also generally more cost-effective than permanent walls and levees. Of course, there's a big caveat. Walls and levees offer greater protection. In Davenport, it's a risk to build near the river. Shawnee Holmes gets that. She's one of a handful of people who lives right along the banks of the Mississippi. 2 months after the floods, the city was still removing debris and slime from the road to get to Holmes's place.
We're about to go into Mud City.
What is Mud City?
The road. The grading goes lower, and as the grading goes lower, it filled up with more mud.
How long have you lived on the river?
All my life, off and on. People think we're nuts for living down here. I mean, how many people spend that much money to build that beautiful home knowing that the bottom's going to fill up with water? Us.
To protect her home, she lifted it up more than 20 feet, and it worked this spring.
I received no water inside my house whatsoever. You can't win against Mother Nature. You can't win with the river. It's going to do what it's going to do, and you just live with it and you conform to what it needs.
But as severe river flooding becomes more frequent and is expected to get worse with climate change, I asked Holmes, is it fair for her fellow taxpayers to pay to fix riverfront roads and services to accommodate a handful of residents who want to live right on the river?
Well, I pay taxes also. So I look at it as though my taxes just cleaned my road. But I do believe that if you come and you live on the river, that you do it with open eyes and know that it's going to flood. And you can't constantly be saying, help me, help me.
While the Mississippi River has always flooded, Davenport and nearby cities were at flood stage this year for 98 days. 4 hours south of Davenport, I met with Colin Wellenkamp.
We're in the city of Arnold, Missouri, just north along the Mississippi River.
We stand next to a flooded city park next to the Merrimack River. It flows into the Mississippi. But because the Mississippi has been running so high, the water in the Merrimack is backing up, and it's spilling over its banks. The floodwaters come within a few feet of the road we're at, where just a few homes are left standing.
Since 1993, they have been buying this property out.
The city wants people out of harm's way and land to absorb floodwaters. It's an idea Wellenkamp supports. Up and down the river, countless acres of urban pavement have replaced spongy soil. Wellenkamp is the executive director of the Mississippi River and Towns Initiative, an association of mayors across the 10 states that border the Mississippi. He says levees serve a purpose, but his organization is looking for ways to return the rivershed to a more natural state in order to protect these communities. But these cities need help. And Wellenkamp says Washington needs to wake up and address what's going on.
If you don't want to call it climate change, you don't want to blame it on people, fine. Don't. That's your call. But we've got to bring solutions to Main Street. Because our people are suffering, we're going...
Wellenkamp says weather-related events are costing the Mississippi River Corridor between 3 and 8% in annual economic growth.
What does that mean dollar-wise? That means we've sustained over $200 billion in actual losses in the corridor since 2005.
And Wellenkamp estimates that this year's flooding could end up costing the river basin another $4 billion. He factors in property damage, crops that couldn't be planted, and stuck barges that can't move products up and down the river. And he says, make no mistake, these costs are passed along to all of us.
1 in 12 people on Earth ingest food made from Mississippi River Basin produced products. All the manufacturing, all the agriculture, and then all the equipment that goes into that economy, impacts all the cities in the country from New Jersey to California. And that is dependent on a working, ecologically healthy Mississippi River Basin.
Cross the river, go a few miles north, and you're in East St. Louis, Illinois. I stand behind a thick pane of glass with Tyler Burvey, who manages the Cargill plant here. A truck dumps corn into a grain elevator.
So it's a vertical belt conveyor with a bunch of buckets on it. And gets up to the top and then dumps in, and then based on wherever the
corn is being moved just a few hundred yards to barges waiting on the river. River transport is the most efficient way to get corn, soybeans, and wheat from the Midwest to the port of New Orleans, then shipped across the globe. One river tugboat pulling barges can transport the same amount as 2,500 trucks.
You couldn't take 2,500 semis from St. Louis to New Orleans in 4 days you just couldn't do it. You know, the fuel, the labor it would take, how it would crowd the highway infrastructure.
According to research from Texas A&M, barges are four times as fuel efficient as trucks and about 25% more fuel efficient than trains. It's not just corn and soy floating down the river. Furniture, clothes, oil products, steel, and chemicals, you name it, they all flow in and out of the Gulf Coast. For Illinois farmers like Greg Gunther, access to cheap river transport is crucial to compete in the global marketplace.
My customers for my corn are all overseas. They're all overseas, every one of them. And we're in a highly competitive situation now with South America, Brazil, Argentina. China does a little exporting of corn. And all these other countries are competing for the same customers that we're competing for. And if our transportation efficiency falls to where we're not the lowest cost supplier, we don't get the business.
And trade flows both ways. Exporters in Asia, Europe, and South America also need a healthy port of New Orleans. Sean Duffy is with the Big River Coalition, a group that seeks to protect commerce along the Mississippi. He says when people in the maritime industry see a photo of a flooded Mississippi River city,
we see that photo, we think, holy crap. I mean, that's truthfully what we see. It's scary. Because the height of the river and the current. I mean,
when the river is high, the flow is faster. And that makes it treacherous for pilots to navigate through New Orleans. Matt Gresham with the New Orleans Port Authority took me on yet another Mississippi River boat ride.
So the city's built around that big turn in the river right there. And that's one of the most difficult or challenging navigation spots in the United States, really, because you have basically a 90-degree turn in the river. You'll see when we get down there the eddies that form in the river, the currents that are pushing in different directions. So it can be challenging for mariners.
Imagine a boat pilot like a race car driver. It's hard enough rounding a turn, then throw some slick rain on the track. Not easy. Still, it's the best way to get goods across the globe. But being so close to this trade corridor can come with a cost. This year, up and down the river, hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland were impacted by floods. Near Quincy, Illinois, soybean farmer Michael Klingner isn't growing any crops this season.
That's why you buy insurance.
That'll cover about 75% of what he lost. He laughs things off, but he's not laughing about what's happening in Washington, or what's not happening. Klingner is also a civil engineer. In the northern stretch of the Mississippi, locks and dams manage the river, but the controls here are far less comprehensive than in the south. So the Midwest floods, like it did this spring.
We get on national news every few years because we have another disaster. We'd like to do something to avoid these disasters.
Back in 1993, after flooding near Quincy displaced 70,000 people, Klingner and other farmers pushed Congress to establish a better flood management plan for upper Mississippi states.
It took from 1993 to 1999 to get the plan authorized, and it took to 2008 for the Corps to wrap up the plan and to present it to Congress.
At the center of the plan, a one-time payment of just $3 million to pay farmers to voluntarily flood their fields during times of high water. But ultimately, the federal government didn't fund the plan.
And it just sat there and died.
Klingner argues paying farmers to take in excess water would benefit everybody along the river system.
We're not asking for a lot of dollars. It's absolutely crazy to leave a system in place that was designed in 1954 and not allow us to make improvements to meet the current weather conditions that we see today. You know, we've got a lot of data. We can keep this from happening again.
Now let's get back to coastal Louisiana, south of New Orleans, and dive into what a disappearing coastal Louisiana looks like from high above.
Sure, our One Fox Charlie is departing VFR with Quebec.
I went for a flight in a four-seat airplane with pilot Owen Bordelon. We left from the small New Orleans lakefront airport.
We're flying generally southward along the east descending bank of the river.
As we leave New Orleans, the landscape looks like Swiss cheese that's been cut up with scissors. Ponds, streams, and canals penetrate the marshy swamps. When the river was allowed to run its natural course, mud, clay, and sand from up north would flow down to the mouth of the Mississippi here. Runoff literally built and replenished the Gulf Coast. No longer. Levees, walls, and dams keep water in the river, but also keep mud and sand out, or barriers push mud to new areas. The impacts can be harsh. As we keep flying south, we see something remarkable out of the window. Tiny communities, houses stranded in the middle of the water. An audio recording produced by the group Restore the Mississippi River Delta narrates what we're seeing below.
The area immediately around Grand Bayou was made up of just 10% water in 1916 and is now 90% water. For this community and others across the coast, Louisiana's land loss is a daily reality.
A ruthless succession of fierce hurricanes have further accelerated decay. The state of Louisiana, along with a lot of other invested parties, is trying to turn back the clock by doing things like pumping in sand and planting more vegetation. They're also looking to punch out holes in levees and let the water, along with mud and sand, reach the swamps where it's badly needed. Seems like a relatively easy solution, but if you punch too many holes, divert too much water, you could alter the modern Mississippi, which basically has become a long canal. Levees don't just protect river cities. Again, they keep world trade flowing. Fix one problem, potentially create a new one.
That's the world's Jason Margolis. He's taking us down the Mississippi today to understand how this one river connects the U.S. to the rest of the world. As you've heard, it's a place of competing interests. As a river, it's a trade superhighway for much of the country and the world, but it's also a ticking environmental time bomb. A lot of people say it's already exploded. But try to fix that, tip the balance in favor of the environment too much, and you could put trade at risk. Solutions won't be easy, but environmentalists and business interests are working together. The world's Jason Margolis finishes our river trip.
Looming over a massive model of the Mississippi River at Louisiana State University hang the words of Albert Einstein. Quote, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." Engineers, environmentalists, shippers, farmers, the oil and gas industry, they're all trying to find a better solution for the modern Mississippi. And as we've said, the challenge is only getting harder with climate change. June Hsu, a professor of hydrology at LSU, is alarmed by the strain put on the river system in recent years. The projections for the year 2100 are worse. Water flows in the river are projected to increase by between 11 and 60%. Professor Hsu says consider even the middle scenario.
That's crazy. That would be huge for this river. I doubt our levee system would survive. I'm not sure.
Add in sea level rise caused by climate change, and he says more and more researchers are skeptical about the state's so-called master plan. It calls for $50 billion in funding over 50 years. So far, Louisiana has raised about $10 billion, much of it coming from settlement money from the BP oil spill, which devastated the Gulf 9 years ago.
Here's New Orleans.
Professor Hsu points to a map, does some quick math, factors in projected sea level rise, and then concludes, even if Louisiana can find the cash to fully fund its plan, the state will still lose the battle. There's simply not enough river sediment out there to rebuild coastal Louisiana.
You understand? So we don't have resource to create new land.
Hsu says we need to face a hard truth. Restoring coastal Louisiana to what was there before, or even completely halting the erosion, this simply isn't possible.
We are losing. Let's not talk about restoration. Let's talk about adaptation. We need to think realistically, by the end of this century, where we have a better chance to protect us.
Put another way, some communities are simply going to be swallowed by the sea. There is, however, another way to slow down land loss in Louisiana. Battle climate change at the start by decreasing greenhouse gases. That means getting off fossil fuels and building more solar panels and wind turbines. The southern states that border the Mississippi River, Kentucky, Arkansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, their legislatures just aren't moving in that direction. In Louisiana, the oil and gas industry drives the economy, a powerful lobby with a history of downplaying the causes and risks of climate change. Angela Chalk lives in New Orleans' 7th Ward.
I live in a house that my grandfather won in a card game. and five generations have lived in that house.
Chalk runs the group Healthy Community Services, a nonprofit that's working to green the neighborhood. That means things like planting trees and community gardens to absorb stormwater runoff. I asked her if her work includes mobilizing people to battle climate change. She says it does, but it's hard.
I know folks who work in the petrochemical industry and the gas industry, and they realize the effects that those industries are having environmentally. But at the end of the day, this is how people make their living. And so how do you speak against your company when they provide you with so much?
That's a reality. I wish it wasn't a reality. But
Steve Cochran is with the Environmental Defense Fund. He says environmentalists can't just pound the table and demand action, like an immediate shift to solar and wind energy.
Let's say we can do this tomorrow and we switch immediately. We're off of fossil fuels. What do we have in Louisiana? We have a huge stranded asset base.
And stranded taxes. But Cochran also says state and federal policymakers need to understand some hard truths. If we continue with business as usual, if climate change continues unchecked and sea levels continue to rise and more frequent, stronger hurricanes pummel the Gulf Coast, it will cost all of us, taxpayers, a lot more money in the long run. And it will become much harder to govern. Cochran asks, is a future governor really prepared to deliver this message?
Things are going to get bad, and we can't exactly tell you yet how bad it's going to be, but it's probably going to be bad, and you need to move. And I've decided, me, the governor, or whoever, that you're going to have to move, so go. I just don't think that's ever going to happen. I mean, in New Orleans, after the storm, we couldn't do that.
Cochran says businesses and environmentalists, historical adversaries, are coming together for the common goal to protect and restore the coast and Mississippi River system. The clock is ticking, and there's simply too much at stake to not work together. Is everybody going to be completely happy with the solutions? Never. But out on his flat-bottom boat with his dog Logan, Ryan Lambert says the time for debate is over.
If you look at what we've lost, and you see what's left here, in the next 50 years, it'll all be gone. They say, oh, we should have done it 50 years ago. Well, today's the first day of my grandchildren's 50 years. Let's start it off. Let's get going. It's not about me. I won't see it. I'm going to be dead. Look at that giant alligator in front. That's a big one.
For the world, I'm Jason Margolis along the Mississippi.
Reporting for this story was made possible in part by a fellowship with the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources. Solace by Scott Joplin takes us out today. To really grasp the full expanse of the modern Mississippi, check out some stunning shots of the river from high above, as well as photos of some of the people Jason met along his journey, all at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your Thanksgiving. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.